From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. The King County prosecutor filed four felony charges of vehicular homicide and assault yesterday against Mark W. Mullen. He's the alleged drunk driver who killed two people and severely injured a mother and her infant child in Seattle's Wedgwood neighborhood on Monday. The case has provoked scrutiny of the state's approach to drunk driving. Is the problem of drunk driving getting any better? What's the history of how we've treated this, and could we be doing better? Drunk driving remains all too common. According to the Centers for Disease Control, it's over 110 million times nationally in 2010. Nearly a third of all car crash deaths in the United States involve alcohol-impaired driving. That's nearly 30 deaths per day. Have stricter penalties for drunken driving had an impact? Can technological solutions provide more help? If you've got a comment, 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW. Michelle Davis is a spokesperson for the Washington chapter of Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. Mad, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
This driver, Mark Mullen, allegedly drunk when he killed these two people, previously arrested for driving under the influence at least five times since 1990, and reportedly he showed up at a DUI hearing drunk last month. He was ordered to have a device in his car. He didn't do it. What went wrong with this case?
Well, I think one of the things that's just glaring at you about this case is that he didn't have his interlock, as you said. In Washington State, because there's very few officers available to follow up and make sure that people have their court-ordered interlock in their vehicle, it basically turns the interlock system into an honor system. And you've got someone who is inherently irresponsible, right? He's made the choice to get drunk and get behind the wheel of a vehicle several times. And irresponsible people are not really great at following up on things. So he didn't follow up. He didn't get his ignition interlock. No one knew. In Washington State, roughly half of the people who are supposed to have interlocks don't have them. They don't get it. And so he was able to get into his car and start it that day.
Is the interlock issue inherently flawed law in that, as you just said, we're talking about irresponsible people in the first place? Why would we expect them to use this device?
Well, I don't know if the law is flawed. I think just the follow-up on making sure when it's ordered that it happens. Because it's incumbent on the person who got the DUI in the first place to call one of, I think there's eight different places in Washington State where you can get one installed. They have to call. They have to make the appointment. They have to do the follow through. And as I said, they're just not responsible people in the first place. One thing that's interesting about this is that at the end of the term that you're supposed to have the interlock for, a year, 5 years, or 10 years, depending on your number of offenses, you have to get permission, basically, to have the device removed. If you go to one of these places that installs and removes them, they're going to make sure that you've, you know, seen through with everything and that it's, in fact, time, and the court has said it's okay for you to get it removed. But there's nothing on the front end, really, to follow up and make sure that they're getting placed in the first place, because we're just so under-resourced and understaffed on that end.
Representative Roger Goodman is a Democratic member of the House of Representatives. He's been representing the 45th District since 2006, and he's been very active on DUI legislation. Roger Goodman, was the flaw here, if we can pinpoint one flaw, the fact that we are not enforcing these interlock devices, making sure that people are using them? What do you think?
Well, we have made some progress. It used to be that you had to get the interlock device after you had your driver's license reinstated. So in other words, people would be convicted of DUI, they'd get their license suspended, and they weren't supposed to drive. That wasn't working, because four out of five people whose licenses are suspended drive anyway, because I guess they have to live their lives. Or they can't control their drinking, and so they'll just, you know, violate the law over and over again. So what we did back in 2008 was introduce a new driver's license, the ignition interlock driver's license. So there was an incentive for people to get a license, drive legally, and, of course, the condition for getting license was to put the thing on the car, this alcohol detection device. So I think more than half of the people are complying. So from my perspective as a legislator, we've made a lot of progress in getting people to put this alcohol detection device in the car, and they're driving with a license. So there's many fewer people driving without a license and many more people driving with this interlock device. And we have reduced deaths by 35% in the last 2-3 years. I mean, we're sort of leading the nation in this. So on the other end are the people who are just not going to, they're not going to get a license. They're not going to comply with a court order. They're not going to put this thing on the car. And so it's hard, you know, there's bad people who do bad things. We kind of, we don't have a defect-proof society.
I guess, Representative Goodman, my question is, are the laws in place to deal with this? Do we need more laws? Do we need better enforcement of the current laws?
So last year, I got another bill through. We got major DUI bills through every year to expand and refine and strengthen our DUI laws, including this ignition interlock program. We got a couple $1 million more for the state patrol to make sure that the devices are working properly and to make sure that the people who are supposed to have the devices in their cars actually have them in their cars. There are 25,000 devices in the cars statewide, and so we're actually tops in the nation per capita. But we can't track down everybody, and so this is a really hard reality that we can't avoid every tragedy because there are people who are going to flout the law at every step. This guy who killed these people the other day didn't obey any court orders, didn't put a device in his car, was driving without a license, had bailed himself out of jail. And so it's just, it's tragic.
Do we need some other way to deal with hard cases like this?
What I'm going to do, I convene what I call the Impaired Driving Working Group. It's all the stakeholders, and Michelle is part of that, actually. Matt has been a very important partner. And we take a look every year. Where are the gaps? What do we need to do to fill in? So the bill that's pending this year strengthens the interlock program, strengthens the felony DUI law. We're going to have a provision about driving the wrong way while you're drunk, increasing penalties for that. So every year, you know, we look to see what gaps we can fill, and this is one of the huge ones. How do we make sure that the people who are supposed to have the device in the car actually do? If you have the device in the car and you try to tamper with it, we know, and that's a crime, and there's a GPS signal that goes off. You can't fool it. We have a camera on the device now so we know that it's you breathing into it. So it's sort of like an arms race going on, people trying to beat the system.
Yeah.
But we're making progress there. But, yeah, we need more resources. We have 3 state troopers statewide to make sure that people have the devices in the car. And needless to say, that's not enough.
Why do we only have 3? I was just boggled when I read that.
Well, I mean, I guess the states that have other ignition interlock programs maybe have 10 or 11, so that would be nice if we could appropriate more money for that. And I'm fighting, actually, to have state troopers paid more in general. State troopers are paid less than pretty much any other law enforcement officer in the state, which is just incredible because of the great work they do.
Well, they can get paid more, but that doesn't mean they're going to be doing this work that we're talking about here. Roger Goodman is a state representative. I want to move on to Baron Lerner. He's a professor of medicine and public health at Columbia University, and he wrote the book One for the Road. It's about the history of drunk driving in the United States. Baron Lerner, thank you so much for your time.
Glad to be here.
What's the recidivism rate on people who get arrested for DUI? Do these laws in general discourage people from repeating this behavior? Baron Lerner, are you with us? Hello. We're going to see if we can get back to him in just a moment. First of all, Roger Goodman, do you know the answer to that question? You talked about the laws and the things that we have done. And have they been effective here in our state when it comes to preventing people from repeating their offenses?
Well, I can comment on a nationwide basis. There are studies that show that if people use interlock, devices.
Am I sorry? Am I talking to Baron Lerner now?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to clarify who we were hearing from. We got you on. So nationally, not necessarily just these ignition interlocking devices, but we've got lots of laws to punish folks who drive while they're intoxicated. And do we see that if they are punished once, they tend to not do the activity again? Not all of them, but in general, does it work to prevent it from recurring?
So the data is pretty clear that there's a segment of the population that will be deterred. These are all interventions that try to deter future drunk driving. So lowering the blood alcohol level, as we did, deterred some drunk drivers. Putting in ignition interlocks deters some drunk drivers. Doing roadside testing of people randomly deter some drunk drivers, but as has been pointed out, there's still a population of people who will not be deterred. And these people tend to be binge drinkers, so they drink huge amounts at one sitting, and then they get behind the wheel. And these are the folks where, as in this tragic case, it's really hard to stop them from drunk driving.
Does law enforcement even get to the issue when it comes to people like that, or is this simply a medical issue? These are sick people who are alcoholics who probably in many areas of their life, not just getting behind the wheel, are just not going to be responsible. Does there need to be another approach?
Well, you know, yes, they're alcoholics and they're binge drinkers. You know, although I'm a doctor, too, and I don't know of any medical condition that says not only am I a binge drinker, but I also have to get behind the wheel of my car. That doesn't exist. So there's absolutely an element in folks who do this of irresponsibility and really wanton behavior. So, yes, absolutely, one would like to get people in better alcohol reduction programs, deal with their social problems. But in the meantime, people are being killed. So the sorts of interventions that were being discussed in the Washington legislature are all to the point.
Now, these interlock ignition devices that would prevent drunk driving that Roger Goodman was just explaining to us, you're very optimistic about those. You mentioned that they really are having an impact. But in this case, we see that there are too few state police officers going out to make sure people are using them. Does there need to be more coming behind this rather than just requiring that people use them? Does someone have to go and check and make sure they are using them?
These devices work for people who are motivated to stop drinking. So there are people who drive drunk once, get arrested, get convicted, they get an ignition interlock, and they see it as something that's helping them to not drive drunk again because they realize what they did was wrong. All of the enforcement in the world isn't going to stop other people from doing it, and frankly, in the current financial situation, all of the efforts of the legislature that could occur, you're not going to get enough people to be able to enforce this.
So what other technological means are there on the horizon to keep people from driving drunk?
Well, there's something very interesting on the horizon, and it's infrared technology. And this is still being developed and perfected, but it's very provocative. The way it would work is that if you put your hands on the steering wheel, in other words, if you're getting in your car and you're about to drive, the device, your steering wheel, would use infrared technology to tell if there was alcohol in your blood, and if there was, you wouldn't be able to start the car.
So it's a car that keeps you from driving drunk.
A car that keeps you from driving drunk. So it's passive. So what's the problem with the interlock is you got to go buy it, you got to install it, you got to not have someone else blow in it.
Yeah.
It's a great technology, but it's really, really hard to enforce. This might be this new technology could be a real breakthrough.
Well, I want to hear from my other guests their thoughts on this. Michelle Davis, a car that you couldn't drive drunk. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's very interesting, particularly when you recognize that very often, or statistically, it's actually been proven that a drunk driver will get in their car intoxicated over 40 times before the time that they're actually caught, or before the time that they actually cause a collision. So I think it's really interesting. I saw a demonstration of this technology earlier this year. I think, as he just pointed out, it still has to be perfected. There's a lot of things like hand gel, antibacterial hand gel, and other things that have alcohol in them that could have an impact on that. So I think when they work those things out, if they can get something like that, it would be amazing.
Representative Roger Goodman, what do you think? Could this be a technological solution to the problem of drunk driving? Would we never have people getting drunk behind the wheel any longer if the car wouldn't work?
Yes, absolutely. So we never, before we didn't have seatbelts. Now every car has seatbelts. We didn't have headrests, now they have headrests. We didn't have airbags, now we have airbags. The original equipment manufacturers or the auto companies protested each step of the way, and now, of course, they proclaim how effective their safety devices are. This is the next step. In Japan and in Sweden and coming in France, every vehicle, starting with commercial vehicles, will have alcohol detection technology in it, so that no one can drive drunk. And so that is on the horizon. I would encourage, and this is a federal matter, we're going to have to get all the car manufacturers to put this on standard, and it's not that expensive. But we really want to put this technology in every car.
Well, this technology that would keep you from driving drunk would presumably measure your blood alcohol content, and if it was over a certain level, it would not allow the car to start. Now, Baron Lerner, the professor of medicine and public health at Columbia, you've been experimenting with these blood alcohol limits on yourself. What did you find?
Well, I did, before I wrote the book, I did a test to see how much alcohol I would have to drink in order to get up to a blood alcohol level that was illegal. And what I found was I had to drink an awful lot. Now, it's different for every person, but I had to drink 3 shots on an empty stomach just to get up to 0.05, which isn't even the legal limit. So the point that this reinforces is, you know, it's hard to drive drunk. You really have to drink a lot. Most people on an empty stomach, you really have to be trying to do that. So the folks that are the problem just really don't care. They're not sitting there saying, oh my God, have I drunk too much? Should I go and have a meal? Should I sit down? They're just people who say, well, I'm done drinking and it's time to get in my car. So this is why I think we need better technology just to prevent these folks from doing that.
Michelle Davis, you want to jump in here?
Well, I think one can be impaired far, far below the legal limit. And so, you know, I question whether or not anybody should ever get behind the wheel of a car if they have had anything to drink. I personally get a little woozy after a glass of Chardonnay with dinner. And so I would never get behind the wheel of a car after that. And I think that in a way these numbers are arbitrary because, you know, my impairment level, your impairment level.
You know, you're getting exactly to the point that I wanted to make. The number must be somewhat arbitrary in that you feel woozy after a glass of Chardonnay. Maybe a 250-pound guy doesn't feel woozy after a glass of Chardonnay. Our impairment levels might be different depending on our physical size, depending on our susceptibility to alcohol. Does one standard work at all, Baron Lerner?
Everyone is different. So, you know, the point is you shouldn't be driving when you're impaired. But the reality is people go to dinner and they have a couple drinks and they want to get in their car. So what you want to try to do is encourage people who feel they have the right to have a couple of drinks to really think about what they're doing, maybe to buy their own pocket breathalyzer, which is really cheap, and measure their level, or even in the best case scenario, the best thing is to have a designated driver, which has been existed for decades and is way underused in this country.
You know, we're kind of into another area now. We're not talking so much about the law as we're talking about social practices and social norms. And Roger Goodman, do you think this is a component that needs more amplification? We see the PSAs, don't drive drunk. We hear a song from Stevie Wonder that says, don't drive drunk. Does there need to be a change in our society and our social mores to get us moving forward on this?
Well, yes, there has been already, and thanks to MAD in particular, the grassroots effort to change the culture. It's not cool to drive drunk. It's not funny. People used to joke about, oh, I ended up in a ditch last night, you know, standing by the water cooler. And so we have, to a certain extent, changed the culture and reduced deaths and injuries in half in the last generation. We have the other half to go. And so the research shows that the number one means to reduce deaths and injuries is to change the culture. And the number two is roadside checkpoints, and I'm going to keep introducing legislation on that. It's kind of hard to do in our libertarian culture out here. And then the third is this technology in the car to detect alcohol. And for that, we want a low a threshold. And so the ignition interlock devices that we use now are calibrated at 0.025, which is, you know, below what's the legal limit. But I'd like to see them calibrated low, so we err on the side of caution. And even if you're not necessarily impaired, it should be understood. Just don't drink and drive.
I've got Roger Goodman with us on the phone, Democratic member of the House. Also with us in the studio, Michelle Davis from the Washington chapter of Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, and Baron Lerner, who's on the line with us. He has written the book on this, A History of Drunk Driving, called One for the Road. I want to bring in some callers who've got some points they'd like to make on this. Amy is listening to us today in Mount Vernon. Amy, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling. What's your thought?
Yeah, I'm a chaplain in the Skagit County Jail, and also I'm the director of a clean and sober house for women. And I guess my comment is that it's not only an issue of just lawbreakers, but really we're talking about an issue of addiction. And so I think that interlocks and penalties, you know, that they are helpful to keep the community safe. But I think if we're trying to deal with addiction from simply a law perspective, you know, just imposing harsher and harsher penalties, I don't think that that's completely going to be effective. And I think that we need to address the issue through treatment programs.
Now, in your work, Amy, do you come across people who have perhaps been arrested on DUIs, who have faced the punishment half of it, who genuinely want to get help with their alcohol problem but can't get it?
I absolutely do see that. I mean, I see often the same women coming through the jail system over and over and over again. And actually, I see a lot of people who hate what they're doing, but they just don't seem to be able to stop because it's an issue of addiction.
No, so, but, you know, if someone's listening to you, Amy, and they're going, it doesn't cost anything to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Why can't they, like, take a step on their own part to try to rid themselves of this disease so they don't have the potential to cause so much harm to the rest of us?
Sure, and I think that people do attempt, you know, their own kind of pathway, but I think that programs like treatment are a lot more effective than just going to a meeting, you know, once or twice a week, even though meetings are great. And I also think that the face of the drunk driver is really changing. I mean, I think a lot of times people have in their mind that it's the old man who goes to a bar and gets drunk and gets into his car, but we also see, like, you know, people that are addicted to prescription medicines getting in cars, and so it's becoming, you know, it's a pretty complex picture.
Amy, thanks a lot for your phone call. I appreciate it. And I want to get a reaction to that, the idea that we have a changing face of the drunk driver. Roger Goodman, what do you think about that?
I very much appreciate the perspective. There are a couple comments I have. The first is that we're not increasing penalties. We did actually last year increase confinement time in prison for those who kill for vehicular homicide under the influence. But other than that, instead of just getting tough, we've gotten smarter on drunk driving. And so that's why we have the ignition interlock requirement. I mean, I guess you could say that's getting tough, and it's a penalty of some sort, but it really is a prevention mechanism. And so it has shown to be much more effective. There's not much research at all that shows that incarceration has any link with reducing reoffense for drunk driving.
Now, I guess I'm wondering, though, if you have an ignition interlock device on your car, you're not going to be able to drive that car if you use it. But you can borrow someone else's car. And Michelle, are we seeing that people who even have these devices, they just borrow a friend's car or a relative's car?
Well, I don't know how many cars you have at your household, but we have several at ours, right? And you add teenagers with cars, and, you know, in a family with a number of cars, then that's a problem. What are you going to do? Put an interlock on everybody's car? I think going back to what we were talking about earlier and what Roger pointed out, we have to make cultural changes. And, you know, we've made it not cool to drive drunk. We need to make it cool to be the designated driver. I think that's a big problem right now, especially with young kids. You know, nobody wants to be the designated driver. That person seems to be a killjoy. It's not fun for them to be at the party or at the bar with everybody. We have to change that mindset as well. Make it cool to be the designated driver. Make it that you're literally the life of the party because you're going to save the lives of your friends by stepping up and being the designated driver. Things like that, fundamental changes in how we as a culture think about this issue from all angles are going to be required. It's a multifaceted problem. It's going to need a multifaceted cure.
Let's go to Dan, who's listening to us today in Ballard. And you wanted to kind of turn back to this technology issue, Dan?
Yeah, hi. I work for a company called Scram within the state of Washington. We use a technology that actually monitors offenders for alcohol consumption. So I just wanted to chime in and kind of follow up on Amy's comments and just let you know that the state is using it extensively and situations where you have a high-risk offender that a judge is typically worried about drinking, they will use this technology to ensure that the offender actually isn't drinking.
So if they had a drink,
wasn't used on this case. I wonder why this guy didn't have that device.
So the state law enforcement officials are using this, Dan?
It's mostly referred from judges directly. We've had over 5,000 people on, about an 80% compliance rate. So it's typically used for a more high-risk offender.
How often do you have to be checked for this to be effective?
The bracelet is continuous. So as the doctor mentioned, passive versus active participation. This is just a bracelet the offender wears on its leg to monitor for alcohol consumption. It's used quite extensively in the Seattle municipal courts and has been adopted wholeheartedly, I'd say, in the last 2 years. So it's definitely a technology that's catching on.
You can't take the bracelet off?
You can, but that would generate an alert, and the judge would be notified, essentially.
So I'm wondering why Mullen, if he was in a courtroom, and granted it was Snohomish County, where he was drunk in court, and the prosecutor called him out, I'm wondering why this wasn't utilized, and maybe it's because
maybe wrong county.
Yeah, I don't know, but you start asking those questions.
Baron Lerner, what about this idea of more closely using technology to more closely monitor people for whom this is a problem? Get away from the vehicle because they could take a different vehicle, and more towards just their own behavior. Do you think that's something we should look at, and does that raise some kind of personal independence and civil liberties issues too?
Absolutely. Look, I'm all for anything getting folks who are irresponsible off the roads. By the way, that's the device that Lindsay Lohan was asked to wear, so it's not just being used in King County. Just to mention the libertarian concerns, you know, it's not illegal for people to drink. It's not illegal for people to binge drink. Now, one can argue, of course, that once they drive drunk too many times, that this is a perfectly appropriate thing to use. But whenever you start putting more restrictive devices on people, you will get what I call in the book a libertarian backlash, and people will say, you know what, this is too restrictive. This has nothing to do with driving. This person should be allowed to drink. They just can't drive. But as we've been talking about all afternoon, the problem is that technology isn't good enough
right.
to prevent them from driving in the car. So it's sort of a catch-22.
Well, a lot more to talk about. We'll have to come back and discuss some of the other issues we didn't get to this time, including checkpoints, sobriety checkpoints, which are a real hot-button issue among civil libertarians. Baron Lerner, who you just heard from, author of the book One for the Road, A History of Drunk Driving. Also with us, Representative Roger Goodman, and with us in the studio, Michelle Davis from the Washington Chapter of Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From KUOW, I'm Ross Reynolds.